Welcome everyone to What's Happening, a bi-weekly podcast bringing you Bitcoin mining and mining related content. I'm your host, Cassie Clifton, and thanks again for joining me today. You might have noticed that I just said bi-weekly. Things are really ramping up for this Bitcoin 2020 conference in March 27th, 28th in San Francisco. So in anticipation for that, I'm cutting back just a little bit. If you have not already bought a ticket, I highly, highly encourage you to do so. Even better yet, if you haven't bought a ticket and you want a free ticket, Bitcoin 2020 has partnered with eToro to bring you free tickets. You can find out more about this partnership. Basically, you sign up for an eToro account, you complete a trade, and then in return, they will gift you a free ticket to Bitcoin 2020. You can find out more at bitcoin2020conference.com. So I really hope you take advantage of that offer. Bitcoin 2020 is going to be a lot of fun. Last year's conference was amazing. Really can't speak highly enough about it. There were tons of things to do, like an all-day-long rooftop beer garden, arcade, satellite events that were taking place. Really awesome speakers. We had a keynote from Edward Snowden last year. This year, we're going to have a keynote from Szabo and Tim Draper. So that's definitely something that you don't want to miss. So for today's episode, I have with me Justin Parola, who is the CEO and founder at Elite Mining Inc. that's based in Washington. I met Justin for the first time actually in Miami at the Mining Disrupt conference last year. And I got home and I was like trying to search all sorts of combinations of Justin and energy and mining and renewables with no luck because I could not only not remember his last name, nor could I remember Elite Mining, the name of the company. So that was really unfortunate. But thankfully, I ran into him again in Vegas, WCC last fall. So here we are today. So a little bit about Elite Mining, for those of you who don't know, or EMI as I'll call it. EMI is creating a vertically integrated renewable energy mining facility in Washington. Today, they're about 94% renewable. They're aiming for as high as 99% as they continue building out their infrastructure. So they'll be responsible for producing much of their own energy, at which case, once they've built all this infrastructure out, they're looking to realize about half a cent per kilowatt hour electricity rates once all of that's in place. But even now, they still have super competitive rates at about 4 cents per kilowatt hour. What I found really interesting about their company, it's very unique in this space. So in addition to like a Series A, more traditional fundraising round, I believe they're the first mining company that is also offering an equity token. So they're doing an STO, which is at a lower price, at least the minimum floor, which allows unaccredited investors to actually participate in this round and gain equity and earn dividends into their company. I've got a lot of respect for Justin, both in terms of his construction and professional background that lent him a lot of experience that really able to help him drive down his overhead costs and build out these facilities with long-term sustainability and profitability in mind, but also for his approach to running a business and the values that he has built Elite Mining on. So today you'll hear about how Elite is able to maintain profitability even in the event that Bitcoin drops below 2K prices, difficulties on working with PUDs or public utility districts to procure power, the unheard of ROI on solar installations that they're working on, just to cover a couple of topics that we're going to dive into. Elite also has some really cool announcements coming out in the next couple of months. So I actually ended up hopping on a podcast to record for just a couple of minutes with Justin on the phone yesterday, just a couple of weeks after we recorded our original interview, so I could get the scoop on some of those. So if you stick around until the end of the episode, you will hear about those announcements, which include more details on their token offering first week of March, their mobile units that are launching in April, which they have not yet shared information on, and the acquisition of two hydro sites that they, I believe they like signed, sealed, delivered within the last 7 days. So that's super cool. So with that, we're going to go ahead and dive on in. Thanks for listening. Justin, thanks so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Cass. I really like your podcast name, What's Happening. It's very clever.
I appreciate that. I actually can't take credit for that. I'd have to give that to Amanda Fabiano at Fidelity. We had breakfast one morning and I was like, you have any ideas for me? And she was like, what's happening? Just like immediately came out of her mouth. And I was like, all right, I think that's it. That solves that one.
That's really awesome. Yeah, it's a great name. And it's so relevant to the markets, especially with Bitcoin dominance. So yeah,
right. And I was thinking like, right, especially like right now as we're around the corner from the happening. So hopefully.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really glad that I ran into you in Vegas again at WCC. And I heard that you did pretty well at the poker tournament, right?
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. We went to the WCPT, had a bunch of poker pros there and some crypto celebs, I guess they call them, like Brock Pierce. And yeah, a couple of the guys were there too as well. But it was a great time. I was really hoping to make the final table, but I got crushed because I lost on kind of a bad beat, but whatever. I'm still sore from that. But yeah, other than that, it was really fun.
What is it like trying to read the poker face of someone who's in crypto? Same as always, or?
It's a great question. So yeah, poker faces for crypto guys tend to be a little bit easier than professionals.
Interesting.
And because we have something in common, like, you know, the chit chat kind of gets a little bit funner, and people tend to be a little bit more enthusiastic about crypto at those tables. So it's kind of more of it's a mix of professionals and amateurs. And so it's hard to really gauge tables because there tends to be a lot of up and down skill ability at the table. So
yeah. And I'd imagine too, with just like the volatility of the market and the swings that we've seen in the past, like some of the people, the OGs in crypto, probably tend to wear their heart on their sleeves just in terms of being very readable people.
Yeah, absolutely. They are. And it's really fun. I went up against Scotty Nguyen a couple times. I actually got him. I got some Scotty chips. I was really happy about that. He's a really, really friendly guy, really cool guy to spend some time with. We got to talk to him for a little while afterwards. But he's a professional, a poker professional. He won first place. I think Lacey won second, I believe. But yeah, I got 14th or 15th, I think.
That's not so bad. That's
yeah, yeah. In the field was like about 100.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, that's extremely good.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. But no, it was really fun. Had a great time. A lot of great networking over there too as well. Is that Michael Turpin's, I think he just purchased that, I believe, a little while ago, but it's Mike Tyson's old mansion. So yeah, a great little spot to go over there and kind of network have some fun.
Would that be the same place that the Hangover would have been filmed?
Yeah, yeah. That's
exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, that's cool. That's super cool.
Yeah, I went in the back and I was like, oh, hey, that's right. This is it's kind of surreal.
Cool,
this is, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Have I made it? Have I made it now? Or is that what I'm, you know, I don't know.
I would say so. I think you've made it if you've been in Mike Tyson's mansion. And maybe, maybe if there had been a tiger, we could say for sure, but.
Oh, that'd be sweet. Yeah, that'd be great.
That would be sick.
Yeah, it's unfortunate he went bankrupt, but I still think Mike Tyson's a cool guy. So.
Yeah, super cool. So I know that you've been traveling a good bit and fundraising, but what else have you been up to these days? What has your life been like the last month or so?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, you're right about that. Essentially, I've been traveling an incredible amount all over the US, and, you know, I'm definitely going abroad. I'm plans to go to Singapore next month, and I'm a road warrior. I've turned into a road warrior. And it's funny because, you know, in typical situations for me, I'm actually really kind of a homebody. I'm not really a road warrior type guy. I'm kind of comfortable in my own little zone. But so what have I done lately besides travel and try to raise money? Let's see. Not much really. Oh yeah, I watched some I'm a big NFL fan, so I like sports. NBA, NFL, I'm a big sports guy. So go Seahawks. Yeah, they're good. Especially this year. They got the first seed right now, which I'm pretty happy about.
I assume that Seahawks is in your top two draft picks?
Yes. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah,
Russell, last name Wilson, man, he's killing it this year. I think he's number two in the MVP voting right now. So I really admire that guy. I actually model a lot of my work ethic and business modeling after that team. Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson really have an enthusiastic organization. I tend to do the same thing for the culture of my company. So I really like that team in general. But most importantly, I drive some of that methodologies to my own business life and just in general in my personal life too. So
that's awesome. That's super cool to hear. Before we get into a little bit more about Elite, I would love to hear how you got into mining, how you got into Bitcoin really, and a little bit more about your background.
Yeah, sure. So let's see, this has been about 3.5-4 years ago is when I actually dived head first into it, when I decided to take the plunge, as you know, a lot of people have their moment. But I actually knew about Bitcoin for quite a while before that, which was really frustrating to me because I was one of those guys who was like, oh yeah, no, Bitcoin is trash. It's going nowhere. And then I started doing some research on it. And I'm like, wow, this is actually a really cool technology. And most importantly, has the ability to change more than just, you know, its initial kind of mission statement, you know. And to me, you know, that was the aha moment was about 4 years ago when I thought, you know, oh, Bitcoin wasn't going anywhere. And I checked the market one day. One of my buddies was like, hey, look at the market. Bitcoin just shot up to like, I think it was like, I don't know, like thousands of dollars or something like that. I can't remember the exact price. But then I was like, oh my God, did I really make a wrong decision? So I was like,
yeah,
okay.
I know the feeling.
yeah. I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to dive head first. And I took all my savings and just dumped it right into mining. And I started out with a large amount of GPUs. I traveled to Canada. I took my truck and got myself a little U-Haul trailer behind me. And I went and I bought, I don't know how many miners it was. It was a lot more than my wife wanted me to buy, that's for sure. I think she probably thought at that time I was literally insane or something had happened to me, you know, going and spending a large amount of money to go pick up these computers from Canada. So she was...
Yeah, it's a wild space. And for someone who like hasn't, you know, been super exposed to it, it almost seems extremely irrational. So it's hard to bring people on board and get them understanding.
It totally is. Yeah. And then like, even when you get them to understand, they still don't understand the specifics and things like, you know, news coming out from the government, like it scares the bejesus out of them. So they tend to, you know, even though they do understand and they kind of, you know, are interested in it, they don't understand like really the full realm of what something really means when news comes out about it. So they get scared, that fear mongering, and then that FOMO, like everyone kind of buys into the emotions. And I'm just like, really, guys, the whole point is to keep even keel and don't get too high, too low, because Bitcoin is, this is a long-term window. This isn't like a short-term, oh my gosh, I got to jump in now, the sky is falling kind of thing. And people tend to always lean in that direction because of, you know, just our inherent human emotions, right? So mm-hmm. Went in the journey, took a chance, and I'll tell you one thing, I'm sure glad I did it, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think all of us in this space would absolutely agree with that. Everyone that's here is glad that they're here and that they took that leap at whatever point in their life that was. I know that you have a background in construction. I feel like at some point you mentioned to me that you were from Florida. Is that right?
No, I was, okay. I'm from Washington State.
Okay, that would make sense. I was going to say, how did you get from one end of the country to the literally furthest most point away? But yes,
I know. Yeah,
if you're from Washington.
Yeah, it's literally the longest flight. I think it's the longest flight.
Yeah, Miami to Seattle, I think.
Yes, it uh-huh. is. That was a dredge. But so basically, yeah, no, I'm from Washington State, you know, born up in the Pacific Northwest. And up here is kind of, a lot of people don't even like think about Washington State in general, which is surprising because, you know, East Coast guys, they don't really care about it. But, you know, Washington State is, you know, massive companies are born here, like some of the most influential companies in planet Earth, you know, like, you know, Microsoft and Boeing and you know, Amazon and, you know, all these different companies. I think Zillow was born here too, I believe.
I didn't realize Amazon was born there. I knew about a couple of the others, but that's interesting.
Yeah. I think I'll have to fact check that, but I know Microsoft, Boeing, and a couple other really influential companies were born here as well.
Yeah. I think a lot of times when people think about that region of the United States, they think about like a lot of just natural parks and forest land. So yeah, it's hard for them to think about like the more civilized areas and innovation that really comes out of that area.
It's true. Yeah. There's a lot of good thinkers over here. You know, Seattle is a melting pot of a lot of Asian culture now. It didn't used to be like that, but in the past 20 years it has been. And a lot of people from, you know, universities and people over here in general just seems to be more pleasant. So I really like Washington State. No knock on any other states, but when I went to New York, you know, the times I go there, it's like, wow, I kind of remember why I like Washington State. So,
yeah, a little bit, like, not quite as fast of a pace of life and able to commute easily.
Yes. Yeah, I know for sure. Yeah. I mean, Seattle traffic's really bad, but I mean,
you also don't have the smell of the city.
Exactly. Yeah, no, for sure. Nice clean air. It's got a little bit of everything. It's got bay. It's got ocean.
A lot fewer rats.
Yeah. A lot fewer rats. That's for sure. Absolutely. Not that rats would only live in that cold environment anyway.
Yeah, not that I don't love New York too, but you know, each city has its own pros and cons. So
yeah, it is what it is, right? So
right.
Yeah. So
you were in construction then in Washington State?
Yes, that's correct. So yeah, I've been building, you know, the majority of my life. I started building, my older brother taught me how to frame houses when I was 14 or 15 years old. I always forget my exact date. Yeah. So it was kind of, you know, just built into me. And you know, from that point when my brother started teaching me that, a couple of years before that, you know, I was a big time nerd. I played back in the day with the games like Blizzard games, Diablo 3, World of Warcraft and those kinds of things, Warcraft 3 before it came out. I was just a kid in high school, you know, and just doing my thing. And then my brother Dan, I have two older brothers, he is the current CTO of Elite Mining, but he and I tried to build computers and mess with them. So I'm kind of a hybrid of both of my brothers, I like to say. I'm kind of a tech guy and I got that from Dan, and I'm a builder, general contractor kind of guy as well from my oldest brother. And I kind of took on both of those. And it's crazy because it's probably one of the most unusual combinations for, you know, business life, but like, this is like, it's like literally the perfect combination for a mining company, having both of those experiences.
What really kind of real estate development were you doing? Was it commercial or was it industrial?
Yeah. Great question. So yeah, for real estate, I started out flipping homes. That's what I did most of early on. A lot of dealing with, you know, hard money lenders, you know, and private investments, et cetera. And then, yeah, so what I started doing is I took the flipping, I took some money and I went ahead and got my, you know, GC license and stuff like that. And then I started doing, you know, light industrial work as well. So anything between, you know, multifamily to complexes and big warehouses or whatever, those kinds of things. And then a lot of custom homes as well. So those kind of fields are, you got to have good customer service skills because they're in super high demand in terms of the customers are really demanding in terms of like change orders and specifications that you have to meet. You know, this business, you know, Elite Mining, now running this, it's a very refreshing because there's basically none of that, which is really nice. So
yes and no. I would say that, like, at least in my opinion, those customer service skills will directly translate in terms of, like, as a CEO, one of your primary roles is fundraising, right? So like, if you don't have good customer service skills, then it's very difficult to fundraise.
Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And, you know, I'm just used to being the head of my companies, you know, the past companies. So yeah, for me, I started doing that. And then going back to the experience early on, I was a trader in the US Stock Exchange. I wasn't on the floor. I always get people confused with that. I just, I used E-Trade, like kind of like everyone did back when, that was 2003 to 2007, I believe. So I got a lot of experience. I earned my tuition, quote unquote. And what that means is that I lost money and I learned. that really helped me out, you know, moving into the future, understanding, you know, what not to do. Anyone that says that failure is not an option doesn't understand what failure really is, in my opinion.
Yeah, I feel like that's hard to exist for any first-time trader too. Like, even if you have done all of your research, like, you don't know what you're doing until you're in the process of experientially doing it.
Absolutely. Especially if you don't have a real mentor. Fortunately, I had a mentor and a couple guys that helped me out. But long term, you end up really learning the most from when you lose. And that to me is incredibly important. It keeps you humble, keeps you understanding.
So in terms of like your background and the experiences that you've had, what skills and expertise are you able to contribute that you feel a lot of other operations out there might not have, like in terms of the knowledge that you're able to now apply to the mining space and building out this facility?
Yes. So like I said earlier, it's amazing our team, like our combination of our expertise that we all have. I think that what most mining operations are missing is that infrastructure part. I think that's critical because even though new technology comes out for miners and they constantly, they do what we call tech cycles, that we just call it that, just kind of named it that. There is no real terminology for it, but hardware, you know, efficiency keeps increasing what we view as, you know, annually and semi-annually, and that will always probably continue, but there is a wall. You know, there's only so much you can do with these chips nowadays, and, you know, we're going to have to go into the next phase eventually of this hardware improvement. And right now, the name of the game, in my opinion, is really lowering your costs. Your overhead are the most critical thing. So for people who are just co-locating and they're trying to, you know, make money as a quick buck or trying to, you know, realize, you know, profits from mining, they got to be really careful because they're paying an all-in cost of much higher than you really should be if you're trying to survive long-term, because this is a survival game. This is not about a race. This is about long-term war of attrition and making sure that you really cross your T's and dot your I's when you're making purchases for these machines, because you really have to look at the market, difficulty, hash rate, trying to figure out what exactly your methodology is going into it. If you don't, you're going to get stung hard. So I think that really infrastructure is a big gap for most of these mining companies, because most of these companies are like just two or three guys that start out and they're just, you know, hey, let's hook up some miners and plug them in and we're going to do really well. It's sweet. That's kind of what I thought originally too. So that's the reason why I know that most people think that. So in general, I think that construction aspect is huge. You know, all that is in-house within the company. So our costs are dramatically reduced as compared to most operations, first and foremost. And then second, most importantly, as we've grown to our first location, now our second location, now we're vetting our third location down in the Sunbelt area, now producing our own energy, becoming completely vertically integrated. And that is a critical part of our model. And that model, to me, makes the most sense, because if you're trying to self-procure everything, you're able to not only have less downtime, but you don't have to worry about third-party people coming in and extending your timelines, creating less friction. And of course, your overhead is dramatically reduced, sometimes by, you know, 40 to 70%, depending on the part of your project for your infrastructure.
Why do you think that it is so difficult for companies to vertically integrate in this space? Do you think it's like the lack of knowledge and experience, or do you think it's just like that they don't know that that's even a possibility?
Great question, Cass. So I would say there's only a handful of people I've ever talked to in the past 3 years that really kind of understand this vertical integration methodology of how you actually do this in a mining business. And so the one thing that I think is definitely a big reason is that it kind of goes back to that one saying, you know, that what I said before, which is that, hey, let's plug in some machines and let's make some money. They don't really understand the mechanics of how the difficulty works, you know, and then, you know, the depreciation of the machines, et cetera. So at first, at first they don't think they need it. They think that they just go buy power somewhere, plug in machines, and they're going to be successful. You know, this is a business. You know, at scale, it's a business. If it's just a hobby, that's one thing. You know, that's a whole different animal because you don't really have to have employees or, you know, contractors come in and help you out, et cetera. But the one of the big misconceptions in the space with vertical integration is, you know, what really is it even is. What vertical integration is in the mining space is you're able to produce your own energy at some level, at least, if not all of it. And then using that, you're able to leverage the best prices for your actual mining. So there's very few companies doing that. Give you example, Layer One was a really good example because Peter Thiel just led that round. I think it was $50 million investment. So basically, yeah, what it comes down to is for vertical integration, you have to have, first of all, you have to have the expertise. That's incredibly important. So if you don't have someone as a head of your company that has that expertise, then you have to hire it on, right? And you have to defer to somebody. So that to me is already in itself a major friction point for most companies to even begin.
Well, then you're also contracting out to someone who has no experience in this space whatsoever, or you're lucky enough to find someone who has like experience contracting with a data center, but those are few and far between.
They are few and far between. And then most importantly, these mining facilities, they're a little bit different than a data center, even though there's a ton of similarities to them. But, you know, they don't need the exact things that like an AWS needs, right? They, you know, these facilities that they use, they're not by any means a mirror of each other, right? So they're inherently different in the fact that, you know, these miners, they don't need like superior air conditioning and a completely controlled environment unless you're in like, you know, I don't know, let's say like Arizona or something like that, where it's really hot. You have to have something there. But for most of these operations, they're in cooler areas. They try to be in cooler areas because they air cool everything. They blow the hot air out of the facility, and that's all you have to do. You don't have to, you know, maintain it like you do a typical data center. So there's that, in that understanding first and foremost. But you're right though. You're 100% right, Cass. Like I look at it like this. If you have to hire out expertise to do all these things, these third-party contractors, they don't care really about getting they care about like getting the job done, but they don't care about, you know, pivoting or anything like that. You just get charged more. It's called change orders, right? So whenever you have to change a job, when you're building out your infrastructure, first of all, your timelines always get pushed out. So if you ever have a change in the situation, just basically earmark it for 3 months of pushing something out. Because if there's ever a change, these contractors, you have to document, you have to paper it. You know, it's always underestimated how long it takes just for communication.
Right. And well, timing is everything in this space, especially in the mining world. If you're like, you know, 3 to 5 months away from project completion, and let's say like at this point, you've already placed orders for your machines so that they'll get here on time, you like just in case there's any delays in the manufacturing process, then like you could potentially just have miners sitting there for, you know, millions of dollars worth of equipment sitting there unused for several months, and you're just losing money.
That's like a game changer. It's like almost game over for most people, because now their perceived profit that they were trying to allocate in their balance sheet and, you know, their P&L, you know, it doesn't exist anymore because you already lost the three most important months. You know, so that can really take down the operation in general. And then a lot of these reasons why that we're mentioning right now is a big reason why these companies fail and they file bankruptcy, you know. So it's very unfortunate because I don't like seeing companies fail, but you know, when you fail, you learn.
Right. No, absolutely. And hopefully you bounce back stronger. I will say though, I think that like in this space, because the barrier to entry for Bitcoin mining is so high right now because of like the cost of the equipment, the amount of like capital that you need to invest, like your monthly overhead costs and the timeline, like just the knowledge and expertise that you need. I think that vertical integration is like slowly becoming more and more prevalent, or at least like slowly it's being understood that that is like a prerequisite to join in this space. Because if you're going to have outside capital flowing in, like since we don't have debt in this space yet, and like it's pretty much significantly like equity-based capital raising, then we have to have vertical integration. Like it's no longer an option. It's a prerequisite to entering the space.
Yeah. It's a prerequisite if you plan to stay around a while.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing too. And I've had this conversation with a couple of other like larger mining operations in the space that I really respect. And it's that like, people are building for the for short-term 1 to 2 year profitability, but they're not thinking about the long-term landscape, and that will put them out of business.
Yep, that'll put them out of business. It's very unfortunate. And the second prong to that, you know, that I really look at is when you're talking about vertical integration, one of the most important factors is who you're dealing with. the people that are around you in that environment. Like, you have to be able to hire or at least have people around you that know what they're doing and can communicate well with you. That is so, so undervalued. It is actually probably one of the most important things, because that can literally sink a project or, you know, grow a project to insane heights. The people around you that you're hiring to help you with that, they have to communicate well. And so part of Elite Mining, the reason why we're doing so well right now is because I have brought over 15 years of experience of people that I've already vetted and gone through, you know, how many employees in the past, and all these people around me, they all trust me, they all buy into my culture. And most importantly, they all understand that, you know, they've seen me come through in the past and they trust me. Therefore, we don't have to give salaries. Our overhead is even reduced even further by the fact that we contract most of our team by using RSAs. So an RSA is a restricted, you know, stock agreement, like kind of like a stock option, but you're not an employee. And they're betting on me and the future value of the company. And now we've grown to, like, I don't know, like 27 people already. So we're very excited about the forward momentum that we have going on right now.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was going to ask how big your team was. 20, I didn't realize that you had so many employees now. That's amazing. Yeah, and it's super important too. I think that, like, for the success of any company in any industry, like, if you don't buy into the vision of the CEO, then, like, I just don't think that it's possible for the company to be successful. I think that's one part of it. And then, like, a combination of, like, loyalty and trust of the employees among themselves and, like, with leadership as well. So,
yes, absolutely. And I'm a big proponent of sharing the wealth. So I really, you know, in my personal life, I'm really altruistic. So I tend to kind of give people more than I should, but I'm just that way. So I kind of carry that with me to my companies. And I say, hey, you know, here's a little extra, here's a little extra here. You know, really, really knock this out for us, you know, and that really feeds into the culture of really forward momentum and creating a lot of push to get things done, because, hey, I've really given you this and I'm working hard every single day to make this happen. Let's really, as a team, let's accomplish this goal.
And it's a very tangible way for you to prove your loyalty to them as well. So
yes, absolutely. That's a great point.
So of the people that you've hired, how would you say that their backgrounds and experiences complement yours?
So let's see here. We have a kind of a four divisions in our company, I like to say. We have a research and development part of our company. We have a construction division of our company. We have our investment committee and then our board. Of that structure that we've created, it's a very organized methodology. And, you know, we kind of, you know, start from the bottom. We research and development for whatever we're going to do. We kind of, you know, we venture off on doing other little, you know, projects that might be good or not good. And, you know, and then we bring it up to the investment committee. The investment committee goes ahead and says, okay, is this, you know, viable for our internal hurdles, a rate of return, you know, IRR, as everyone knows. And is this a good idea? Then we say yes or no. Then it goes to our construction division, starts planning it out. And then the board signs off on it. And that's the kind of the structure we've created it within our company. And for the people that we've hired, they all fit into those categories. So we have, you know, commercial electricians, you know, electricians in general, people who, you know, obviously in the past have built with me, you know, homes and light industrial stuff, et cetera. Getting back to 10, 15 years, I still have guys with me that have been around me forever. So
Have the luxury of having the network, an extensive network already built up for that.
Exactly. Yeah. Which was just like, it just fell into my lap when I got into mining. I didn't even think about it at first, but just like, wow, it's great. I have this already. So it was pretty neat. And there's another big proponent I think that is probably undervalued as well, which is research and development. So understanding the market cycles, understanding how, like, future things will in the marketplace, those market forces rather, will affect the hash rate or possibly affect the price. I think those are important to at least estimate. Not that you can ever guarantee anything, but at least having a good idea and grasp of what the market's doing in the future. A great example is the Bitcoin halving, which is the name of your podcast. So the halving is really critical because there is a huge wall of we haven't finalized the research on this, but I think it's like anywhere between 50 to 70% of miners out there are S9s or a type of S9 version. And if the price of Bitcoin doesn't go to like that 15K mark in the next 6 months, there is going to have to be a ton of S9s that go offline. So what we're doing is we're hedging our bets a little bit by buying some of the S9s if the price does go up. And then people are, you know, or whatever, and because we can get them for really cheap right now, as a good example. And then if it does go up, that's great. But if it doesn't, then it's likely that a bunch of S9s will fall off of networks, and then the hash power will go down. At that point, the difficulty will decrease, and then you can actually mine more because obviously the difficulties decrease. So that's just one example of dozens of things that we look into in our research department. And then, of course, our investment committee and our C-suite officers, all high level, have a ton of experience. Our CFO, Justin English. CTO Dan, my brother, he's a principal engineer for Zillow.com. He's been there for, I don't know, I think almost a decade. Very smart guy. Like I told you, he's more of the nerd side than I am. I'm kind of a hybrid between the two brothers. and then just, you know, in general, looking for highly motivated people. I really put a big value, Cassie, on people who actually have drive. For me personally, I could give a crap if you have a college degree or not. I want to know, do you want to learn and do you want to kill it with me? Do you want to make this company something special or do you want to be a big part of it? If that is the case, I'm willing to reward people who are willing to really take a dive with me, because if they're in it with me, I know that I'm going to get 100% out of them, regardless of their knowledge. At least have, you know, if they have, you know, some kind of familiarity, that is important. But I mean, at the end of the day, I'm really looking for people who have that drive and that motivation to really create something special.
Right. And that's incredibly important, especially in a space that I would venture to say has infinite rabbit holes, right? Like if you're not curious and you're not motivated and you don't have drive and, you know, you're not like able to like take things on by yourself and you have initiative of your own, then it is extremely difficult to succeed in this space. There's just so much to learn and time is moving so quickly. I almost feel like time moves faster in this space than it has in others for me.
It does. I can't believe I've already been here for three years and change. It's just crazy.
It's crazy. Yeah. 2019 has just flown by. It's been a great year, but it's also been just so fast, like almost a blink.
Blur. Complete blur. It's crazy.
Right. So you guys have been operational since 2018, right?
Yeah. So we actually opened up the corporation in May of 2018. That's correct.
Okay. I would love to get a feel for, I know 2019 has been extremely busy for you and the team. What have been sort of like the major milestones that you've accomplished throughout this year?
Okay. So quite a few. Let me start with the most important one, which was we closed, of 2018, we closed our seed round for 1 million. That was significant because, you know, the amount of legwork and trying to get people to buy into my vision of what a mining company should be was extremely difficult. Because mining in general, especially for people who don't understand it, is like trying to sell ice to an Eskimo, you know? So,
and were you primarily, in terms of investors, were they within the space or were they outside the space or?
Yeah. A couple outside of the space. I would say a little bit of a mix of both, Cass.
Okay.
So I would say that, you know, really it was a mix of both, but the people that were inside the space have more skepticism because they understood, you know, what's been happening to, you know, the majority of miners. And really, are you legit? Are you a scam or are you legit? And that's really an important differentiation because a lot of people in the space already are familiar, at least, if not fully understanding of what mining is. But then you have to really sell to them, you know, hey, this is the reason why we're going to make it. And other people are, you know, they're full of crap. And that really is the most important driver for trying to sell people who are in the space already.
Mm-hmm. And so Series A, and then
some other
milestones.
So, absolutely. Yeah. You can look at our roadmap too. We have a really cool one on our website. But essentially, that's what we started out with. Then at the beginning of 2019, we started preparing for the STO launch, which is the Series A. And then the amount of work that goes into that, I mean, I don't even want to talk about how much money I paid lawyers. I'm kind of against the grain kind of guy, I guess. I don't know. I don't like spending money on lawyers in general, but you kind of have to.
It's a necessity.
Yeah. Vampires are vampires, whatever. It's just how it works. They're bloodsuckers, but whatever. It's all good. I tend to always lean towards, you know, growing a company and operations rather than, you know, the paperwork side of things, but it is what it is. So we started that. We finalized our contracts with the PUD, our first major one. We're working on our second one right now down the Sunbelt area right now as we speak. That was a major milestone. That took like a year to put together. These long-term contracts with these, PUD stands for Public Utility District. It can also be called like, you know, electrical companies or whatever layman term you want to put on it. But these PUDs essentially, they're cautious, especially up here in Washington, but they're very cautious about who they do deals with because they want to make sure they're not going to be held out to dry. So essentially, that was a big deal. We finalized that. Then we started doing construction of facilities, retrofitting. We made some significant milestones there. We made our first large deployment of our machines in that time frame in the earlier 2019.
How many megawatts was that?
We only deployed just over 500,000, and we bought, at the time it was determined that the A9s were the best way to go. That was, InnoSilicon. And yeah, so we bought them at the peak of like $3,000, whatever it was.
Oh, I bet that was good. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Since we're in this weird market where like hardware and the price of the asset it correlates.
It definitely does. They really price it, you know, in accordance to how that kind of fluctuates. But yeah, so back then we spent $500,000. So that wasn't very much though. It was like maybe just over a fifth of a megawatt or something like that, roughly give or take, because, you know, that was how much it cost back then for those machines. Mm-hmm. It was definitely the right decision. We've done really well on those, already paid ourselves back on those and are moving forward. Then let's see, what else did we do? We procured and bought another location. So one thing that's really interesting that a lot of people don't do in their, you know, in their companies and mining companies is they don't really focus on the real estate part. For us, it's important because we want to garner, assets. We want to own everything we do. So we can build that balance sheet. So when someone invests in our company, they actually have, you know, tangible assets that they're actually investing into as well. So, you know, let's say worst case scenario, something does happen to our company. You know, we got millions of dollars in real estate sitting there. To me, that's really important as well.
Significantly advertising for non-endemic investors as well.
Absolutely. Traditional investors love that part of it. So, and for us, it makes more sense because, you know, also most importantly, when you look at lease versus buy and mortgages, you're always ahead by doing mortgage, for the most part, if you do it right. If you're leasing, you're always paying more, and then you obviously realize way less value long term. It's no brainer in my opinion. But that's just
I'm definitely feeling that with the apartment that I'm renting. I feel like I'm throwing away money every month, and I like can't bring myself to buy a house yet. So
yeah, I would wait, Cassie. I'll wait about a year and a half. Yeah, I'll wait about a year and a half. You know, there's a lot of people forecasting recession, and the best time to buy a house is in a recession. So wait till it's a buyer's market, anyways.
I actually have a friend that works for Capital One, and they are already preparing for the recession.
Are they really?
Mm-hmm. So I would assume that the other banks are as well.
Yep. I would think so too. And all of a sudden, once that capitulation hits, it's on like Donkey Kong, man. Everyone's just going to just go ahead and, you know, just sell. That's just how it goes.
Yeah, it's going to be a little scary, but...
Yes, it will. And I'm actually a bit worried about it in general, just because, you know, the last one was something, but this one could be even something else. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. But back to the 2019, those are our major milestones. We have a few more things that were kind of smaller, but not too big of a deal. But yeah, we launched our Series A for $6.4 million. We landed our lead venture capitalist, and we're going to market, for lack of better words, with our Series A. So we're really excited about our security token offering.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into that, but I also have some questions just kind of while we're on the subject of like overhead and cost basis and the contracts you have with PUDs. I assume that you guys have some PPAs, which are power purchase agreements, in place. What sort of like time period are you looking at there, and what are your electricity rates?
Yeah, great question. So here in Washington, it can vary anywhere from like about, you know, 2.8 cents-ish to about 5 cents. So the one thing that's really critical that if anyone's ever going to get into space is they need to realize that takes time. These companies are, you know, in Washington's case, they're publicly owned. So you can't just walk in there and just be like, hey, can I get some power? And they're like, yeah, sure. That sounds good. Like, yeah, it just doesn't work that way. It's months of negotiations. The timelines are stretched out because they're doing their due diligence, making sure that, you know, that you guys are, first of all, legitimate. And then, you know, all these guys are going to follow through. You have to buy bonds. You have to do deposits. It's very expensive. And you have to make sure that you are following the steps appropriately, and then you're budgeting properly, and then realizing how much the cost is when you move forward with it. So, you know, all those things are important. And for the most part, most PUDs and electric companies, they're going to require a large deposit up front to do studies. So you're at risk anywhere between $10,000 to $100,000, depending on where your location's at and what you're trying to accomplish, just to actually get the ability to do a PPA in some cases. So you're risking a lot of capital just to actually even start the conversation for most of these companies, depending on where you're at. For us, the power rate doesn't matter too much in the long run because, you know, we're going to be doing self-production and net metering essentially. And then
what
eventually
percentage will be produced like internally?
For right now, we're not doing any of it, but because we focused on infrastructure for preparing to deploy all the solar and other types of energy production. But it's going to be, after we close, right around the 75% mark, give or take about 10%. And it really depends on how the cost of the infrastructure falls into place. There's a lot of moving parts in this because we also want to do battery backup a little bit, but we don't want to spend an incredible amount on it because it's just not really cost efficient at all. But you kind of need to have it, in especially if you're going to deal with some of these PUDs in the Sunbelt area, because during the peak times, you want to be able to cover your own mining, because then you can significantly reduce your costs for your demand. And in those cases, that is really, really important, because that, you know, affects your bottom line and your overhead dramatically. So it just depends on, you know, how much you raise and how much you're sizing your operation for. But essentially, yeah that's where
it's super interesting. We're sitting at about 65. I worked for a couple of years ago, an energy conservation company, but like we had several like industrial companies that we were working with, and we had actually suggested to them that they shift completely their operations by like a 12-hour period so that they were working throughout the night just to lower their demand, because demand during the day is significantly higher than it will be throughout the night, right? So
absolutely, especially down you're 100% right, especially down in the Sunbelt area. Air conditioning turns on, it's like anywhere between five, depending on what area, anywhere between like 5 to 8 times the nighttime load. It's crazy. Because, you know, everyone down there uses air conditioning, obviously, especially in the summertime. You know, like Arizona, it's like 120 degrees up to. It's like
it's wild. Like,
yeah, it's desert too. You can even go running, you'll die and pass out.
Dramatically drops overnight. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's really critical that you size it appropriately, and you're making sure you are actually buying enough to, you know, produce solar and your own energy, but also, you know, not trying to starve yourself of actual, you know, miners, because you got to produce revenue. But you have to balance it out very carefully. But that's the planned percentage amount.
So then in that sense, like what would be like phase one, not having your own energy deployed just yet? And then phase two, being able to deploy, like, you know, having that infrastructure built and being able to use your own energy instead of procuring it. What would be the different, like the cost difference or like your projections there?
Yeah. So basically it comes down to right around to the higher 4-cent range initially without touching anything for our self-generation. You know, and we've already accomplished that. We already have our first and second locations for that. And then once we start deploying this, our cost basis will go down to right around 1.5 to 2.5 cents, depending on the location. We have three of them now, or we have two now, but we're about ready to do a third that we're looking into right now. Actually, we're getting close on that one. And then that is phase one finalized. Phase two is after we start generating revenue, then we either, you know, A, raise more money, or B, we can use some really interesting products in the market right now that are being really creative, you know, buying hash power and other sorts of things to fund more miners, increase our revenue, and then get to the point where we can do phase two. Phase two, we will get to right around a fraction of a cent. So phase two would be in the line of around... Yeah, I know. I'm super excited about it.
So that's got to be like bottom 0.5% in the world, right?
Correct. That is correct. Yeah. And if you're that low, one of my high level things I like to say is it's going to be almost impossible to fail. Because if you're the beauty of self-generation is that it's a known commodity. Everyone understands what self-generation means. You're producing energy. Energy is the most important thing in the world besides, you know, food and, you know, someplace to sleep, I guess, right? So at that point, not only do you actually self-produce that much energy, which is, you know, good in general to do, especially for a green environment, which, you know, we're big on, you know, green energy and what we do there for that. But most importantly, I mean, you're completely hedging your bets. Like you have... Where other people are like the lowest rates they can get are 1.8 to like 2.8 cents, you know, in some areas of like, you know, Canada and I forget what's called Newfoundland, yeah, and in Texas and whatnot, we're well below that. So at that point, yes, we spend a lot more money on the infrastructure up front, but long term, it pays itself tenfold. So let me give you an example. If I was to theoretically have a fraction of a cent in energy costs, then an S9 that I could buy right now for, you know, anywhere between $80 to $120, depending on the condition, I mean, that ROI is in a month and a half. And nobody can touch that. It's just untouchable. So it's so exciting for us because we have the team in place to do it, you know, seamlessly in terms of, you know, in-house and make it happen. So we're really stoked about it for sure.
That's super exciting. So then if you were thinking about like, okay, let's say that you're at 0.5 cents per kilowatt hour, what then would be like just not including overhead, but just your like operating costs? What's the lowest price of Bitcoin where you would be able to break even?
I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but I can tell you that I know it's really close to around like, I want to say it's around like 1500, I believe.
So where it's at. That might be the lowest that I've heard yet.
Yes. Yeah. It's absolutely sick. And then the reason why is because, again, we don't have salaries in the company, right? So everyone is basing their value off the token. The token is for lack of better words, it's kind of like the ecosystem of the company. And we give out dividends depending on performance. As I mentioned before, these RSAs, we're generous with them when we give them out. And then we incentivize you to hold those tokens, you know, because the tokens represent common shares in the company. And those will be on exchanges eventually in, you know, next year or so, especially as security markets develop. And those dividends is because you bought in, because you did all this, you get this big reward, and you know, proportionately you're receiving all these dividends coming in. And I mean, it's for the end user that's involved in the company, it's a no-brainer. You receive so much more value than you would a salary or a paid wage.
Right. So they're able to, like, in the meantime though, not having the salary, they're able to live off the dividends.
Oh yeah, great question. So yeah, during the time, it's very hard for us to hire people and contractors and whatnot because we have to look for a very specific person. We're looking for people who are like kind of self-sustainable. They have their own, like, you know,
safety net.
Yeah, their own safety net. Thank you. And then what we're looking at is, you know, people who can contribute part-time. And then eventually when we, you know, get bigger, we know we're not going to be able to stay away from that forever, but like, you know, 3-4 years down the road, whatever that is, then we have to start, you know, hiring, I guess, for lack of better words, like grunts, you know, lower end employees, just bird watching the facilities, et cetera. So yeah, no, not initially, no. Dividends are going to be after the security token is launched, which, you know, it's right around the corner though. So
when do you anticipate launching that?
The token generation event for the Series A, we call it a TGE. We're planning on being OFN right away, hoping to be on T0 following that, and then other security tokens. There's a couple in London that we're looking at, and other places as well. That's going to be, let's see, it's December, so it should be by the end of 2020. Might be sooner, but you never know because it's hard to really forecast like when you're going to hard cap around.
Right. No, I totally understand that. And everything is all about the timelines and making sure that they line up. But there's some things that you just can't anticipate. So,
yeah, absolutely. There's always that variable that you can't like, you can't control. Like you have an investor come in. He's like, hey, here's $5 million. You're like, oh, that's sweet. And then they're like, but we have to wait 6 months because of due diligence. Like, oh,
right. Man. You might know most of the coefficients, but there's going to be a couple that you just could, you know, vary in magnitude.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Cass.
So I'm really curious to know a little bit more about the tokenization, because I know you raise capital through Series A, but you also raise capital through allowing the public to buy tokens as well with like a minimum of $7,500 buy-in. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Is that still ongoing or has that already closed?
Yeah. So we're actually launching it. What we did is we took pledges and then we basically kind of have like a line of people, like, you know, they got, you know, whoever pledged earliest, first come, first serve basis, and they were able to be on the top of the list. So typically Series A, and at least the way I understand it, and I've always done this in the past with my other companies and experience in equity markets, Series A are typically geared towards venture capitalists. That's what you do. You launch a Series A, you go find these firms that want to dump a bunch of money and diversify into your sector, whatever. And then you kind of just wait it out, do due diligence, you know, months at a time. It's a war of attrition. It just takes forever. But we decided is that we want to try to be, you know, on both sides of the fence. So not only that, I think that is smart for us overall in terms of timeline, but also allows us to have the ability to involve a community. There's a lot of things that being a good actor in the space can garner in the future, we believe, including like democratizing mining power and pools, et cetera. But essentially the timeline is pledges for the first, it's been like 1, 2, 3, 4 months or so. And then we're actually launching it and opening live to go just straight to subscriptions. There are, you know, our lead investors, et cetera. So the opening of the round is happening in mid-January. And then we're going straight to subscriptions, which means that everyone that, you know, is at the front of the line can then, you know, we'll be at the first and get the earliest benefits of the lowest amount in a USDT or format.
That's really exciting. I love that. I think that right now for your average Bitcoiner who probably isn't an OG Bitcoin millionaire, or maybe they, you know, are also working a 9-to-5 job and that's like their primary source of income, but they don't have that security net that they could fall back on. finding opportunities to get involved in the mining space, those are few and far between right now.
They really are.
One that is extremely legitimate like yours is. So having that like equitable opportunity for the community to be involved in the mining space, I think is really, really important and very, very unique in this space. So it's very exciting.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. It's humbling, but I'll tell you one thing for sure. For green mining, and we want to push this notion forward, we want to really push this mission statement of, you know, there is no reason why it can't be green. You know, what we are trying to accomplish is, you know, on both sides of the token, we're trying to involve the community. We're trying to, you know, make sure that we're garnering attention, not from just, you know, the bigger funds, but allowing people to get more involved in what mining really is, right? Like I'm trying to figure out, essentially what you're trying to figure out is, what is the actual traction rate for people coming in an accredited investor environment for our security token offering? So at that point, we want to try to invite people to come on board. We want them to be shareholders of the company. It's very unique in that kind of offering. And what we're trying to make the space realize is that it is profitable and it is actually the best solution to do green energy and self-production of energy. And you're able to make the most money long-term. It's about the future planning, right? A lot of people are so short-sighted or they have the ability to, or they, they're either short-sighted or they have a short window that they look at, you know, 1 to 2 years, but you really have to look at the long-term because, you know, what's sustainable? What is long-term going to give you the most bang for your buck? And, you know, it's just like building a house, which is, I kind of refer to this often within my company meetings, et cetera, but building the foundation of what is the most important and then building from there. And that takes time and effort to build the correct foundation for a company, especially like this. You know, oil and gas, no knock against them in general, but just, you know, I just don't think that people realize that the world is trending in the green direction, that cost of solar is going down constantly. Cost of storage is going down constantly. That's where all the money in research and development is going into around the world, around the globe. And so, you know, when you're deploying, you know, like for example, the Texas operations and, you know, they're doing good, they're doing great. That's awesome. And they have cheap cost of electricity, et cetera. But if you're doing like generation of gas, for an example, you have a huge upfront cost. And even if you finance that long-term, that in itself is a depreciating asset that doesn't last long-term. Where, you know, if you take solar, all you have to do is you have the entire infrastructure set up on the property when you deploy all your solar. And all you have to do is replace panels every so often. And in most cases, if a panel goes bad, then you have a warranty on it. So you just get a brand new one for free. So, you know, there is long-term, when you're talking about infrastructure of self-production of energy, you have to account for the fact that long-term you have maintenance costs, and maintenance costs are just absolutely tremendous when you look at your overhead for, you know, oil and gas, because, you know, solar is not mechanical. Battery backup is not mechanical. There's no, you know, there's no engine, there's no moving parts. And, you know, you have to constantly maintain that. And that costs a lot of money when you're talking about large generation of power for gas. So it's really, really critical in looking at it from that perspective.
And I think so much of it too is like so industry specific, because I know the cost of solar is falling so rapidly. I mean, we even have a number of manufacturing plants that are priced really, really favorably here in the US. It depends on the project type and you know, the type of ROI that you're going to see for people to really open their eyes to that. So I'd be curious to know, I know for a lot of solar projects, you're looking at like 10 to 20 years, really just depending on the size and the location for, you know, the solar index there. What about for you in Washington? What does it look like for ROI on your solar panels or on wind or hydro that you're installing?
Yeah. So essentially for Washington state, it's obviously less. There's more clouds and the wintertime is not obviously suited well for that. So we're not going to do a lot of it up here. We're definitely going to do some, but it's not going to be significant by any means. It's going to be just one of our, you know, locations that have that, you know, 2 to 3 cent capability. Down the Sunbelt area, that's obviously a whole different ballgame there. But to be specific to your question, what it really comes down to for an ROI, it depends on how you mine, right? If you're able to, in our case, you know, and I'm kind of giving out a little bit here, but that's fine. I'm cool with it. in our case, buying secondhand miners is usually the better way to go, especially if you have in-house expertise on how to fix them, how to, you know, procure parts, et cetera. All those internal departments that actually, you know, mitigate the cost and damages that can happen to your overhead and your CapEx through having bad machines that come up and et cetera. And if you buy secondhand, you're able to lower your costs by a significant amount. And in doing that, the reason why I'm explaining this is because when it comes to the solar ROI in Washington State, be about roughly 2 to 3 years. And down the Sun Belt area, you know, effectively, depending on how things go in the future, I don't got no crystal ball, of course, but depending on how we land on our prices for our miners in the future over there, we're looking at anywhere between 16 to 24 months for an ROI, which is, honestly, it's unheard of. And
I was going to say, I've never seen that before, but that's incredible.
Yeah, literally. It's when I tell that to people, they actually literally label me as a liar. They're like, nope, you're a liar.
Yeah, have to provide some context there for that to make any sense.
Exactly. I'm like, here's our research and here's what we've done. And this is what we're assuming here in these categories, da 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 da. But yeah, essentially, you know, and the reason why the most important factor is, again, it's that labor cost. That labor cost is so critical. And our operation doesn't have labor costs. So what I mean by that is, like, you know, on our actual CapEx. So if we have, you know, $1 million and we're going to go build something, typically 50% of building something is labor costs. Well, guess what? We don't have that cost. So you literally just cut that immediately in half. So that is, in a sense, an incredible advantage that we have in our operation because of the culture and trust factor we have within the company's mission statement.
That's amazing. I would also love to know, what are some companies in the space that you partner with?
We're partners with, I wouldn't say we're official partners with Salt, but we are very privy to Salt and their operations there. A bunch of great guys over there for sure. We're partnering up with Hashrate. I'm not sure if you know about them at all, but they are building operating systems for mining, trying to, you know, cover a large category of mining rigs, not just, you know, a few, you know, here and there for firmware, but essentially trying to create, like, you know, almost like a Windows 95, you know, early day version of operating system for miners. They align with our mission statement a lot, and they really like what we're doing. So we found really good synergies there with that company. So we're partnering with them. We have a few other partners that people wouldn't really know or recognize at all, but they're local businesses that assist us with, you know, building out infrastructure, which again is, you know, in our opinion, one of the most critical parts of our company. And anywhere between, you know, electricity, engineering, you know, procuring materials, offshore, you know, purchasing, et cetera, those kinds of partnerships. And for right now, that's the majority of it. We have a couple of other ones that are really exciting that we're going to announce pretty soon, but those are closed door for now.
Cool. Well, I definitely will look forward to that announcement. So before we dive into, let's just say, a rabbit hole, what would you say has been the greatest challenge for you in building out this company?
Now, that's a good question. That's a very complex answer.
Probably, I'm sure there have been quite a few, but...
For sure. It's a very complex answer, though. I would say the number one hardest part about building out a company like this, especially the way I'm doing it, because I'm asking a lot of people who are involved in my business, because I'm basically saying, hey, trust me. In our case, the hardest part has been really garnering interest and raising money. Now, I wouldn't say that we have, you know, we've done poor at that. It's just the amount of time it takes from me. I'd rather be doing operational things, right? So for me personally, I love to be involved in day-to-day activities. I love to, you know, try to help the culture, boost people up and lift them up and really try to, you know, motivate them and get, you know, get tasks completed to move the company forward. So for me personally, in not the mining category, but just in our business specifically, that's been the most difficult thing because there are so many mining operations that are scams. And what I mean by scams is some of them actually are scams. They plan to be a scam. They are, you know, trying to basically steal in one way or another, trying to, you know, trick people into giving them money. But then you have a bunch of operations that really aren't, you know, their intentions aren't like that, but they just don't understand that they really aren't going to succeed of the way they're doing it. And you can, if you're in the space, you can recognize them pretty quickly. But even some of the better actors that like are really trying really hard, they just don't have the right ingredients. And for me, I'm a very altruistic person. I always try to reach out and help people and try to give them, you know, some real good advice on what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. And really what it all comes down to is you really don't want to try to get too big too fast. So, you know, really the hardest part has been raising money because right now mining has a pretty bad name in general. I said that wrong. There's a lot of companies trying to quote unquote raise money have bad names because they're failing by the dozens. And there has been a phase of companies that are, you know, quote unquote green energy companies. And they, you know, if they had token sales, they raise money and they're like, you know, they send an email, hey, where are you guys at? And they're getting no responses. And it's because it's because they're failing left and right, because they're not really understanding the barrier of entry is a lot more complex than they think. It's not just buying machines and plugging them in. So raising money has been really difficult in that. But for the mining industry in general, Cass, I would say that probably the most difficult thing is really understanding the difficulty. You know, people really have a hard time understanding difficulty, where it's headed, you know, the deployment of new mining machines, mining rigs, and the tech cycles that exist, that again, be called tech cycles, what really that means for the difficulty rate going up. So when you buy a machine, you think, oh, it's going to make this much money for another, you know, 6 months or whatever. Then you get a delay. Or if you don't get a delay, you get your machine. Let's say that you get your machine, you know, luckily, and then you go ahead and deploy it. You know, you install your machines. And then you go at it. Well, the reality is that you don't know exactly what the difficulty rating is going to be. You can only estimate it. And in most cases, it's usually more than you think. And so it's really critical in your projections to really calculate what the, you know, what the worst case scenario you can be. And then you have to go from there.
Right. You have to model a number of different scenarios. And it's super difficult. And I think like trying to predict difficulty is in a lot of ways like trying to predict the price of Bitcoin in the future. You know what those certain factors are that will really affect the price of Bitcoin, like just from economics 101, right? But at the same time, there are like, and you can look historically and use that data, but at the same time, there's so few historical data points for us to actually look at to see like where those inflection points are and how they affected us. And then there are a host of unknown factors that you could never predict, or you could never, you know, find a way to get like collect all of those factors and then put them into an equation to help you model what's going to happen in the future. There are always going to be unknowns in this space. So
Yeah. And that, and the tail off of that, you know, the industry is still so nascent. People don't realize that. Like I see people, like I'm on Telegram all the time and people are all just, you know, just a big pity party and whining, oh, the price is going down. And it's like, you know, guys, you guys got to plan for this stuff. You can't just think that the market's always going to be good. I mean, yeah, long-term the growth is happening. There's, you know, obviously traction in the past 11 years, but I mean, we're still so nascent. We're still so early. This is such an early technology in terms of that. Like if you think about the internet, it took like 20 years to really start like having worldwide adoption. You know, I mean, so
yeah, when I was watching yesterday YouTube videos from like it was like a YouTube video from like 10 years ago, and just the video quality I was astonished by. I was like, I did not realize how much progress we've made in 10 years. It's unreal. And dial up and yeah.
So. Yeah, no, it is. It's really good. And it's really good to go back and look like you did, because when you're always in the moment, you just tend to forget because you take things for granted, right? You're just like, oh yeah, it's great. This is cool. And then it's like, you know, you look back, you know, at like I was looking at, what was I looking at the other day? I was looking at videos. Oh yeah, that's right. I was looking at my child videos and stuff like that. And like some old videos from my old phones and stuff. And yeah, you're right. The video quality is like terrible, like compared to now.
Right. Like, and it was like, yeah, we were just so excited to have that kind of technology at our disposal then. But
Yeah. It's like almost like it's like black and white versus color television, right? I mean, it's just it's like that much of a difference. So it's you have to keep in mind, you know, cognizant of the fact that you know, you really have to really figure in that we are so new still. So
one thing I'll say in response to kind of, you know, sifting through a lot of the scams in the space. Yes. I think the further that we get away from 2017, the better that it will be for the space overall. It just in general, I think that like we've weeded out a lot of companies that really just their intentions were not benevolent at all. And, you know, really we're just looking to take advantage of people who, you know, were FOMOing in at that time. And that goes for the mining space as well as like those just wanting to, you know, buy tokens and be a part of the craze. But what else would you say are some ways for people to like sift through and identify those who have that potential to exist on the longer term horizon and those people who are, you know, that their intentions are rightly placed?
Yeah, that's a great question. That one is really comprehensive, but at the highest level, Cass, I can answer that question very specifically. You want to ask questions. You want to ask dozens of questions. You want to try to formulate the best questions you can literally find out and just do your research. Of course, obviously, everyone says that, but to not be so cliche, I want to bring something a little to the table a little differently here. And when you're looking at a business or a company that is trying to accomplish something, really think about, first of all, are they ahead of their time? Are they too far ahead of their time? Is there a demand for something that they're actually doing? Like you have to look at the product and say, or product or service or whatever they're doing. And you have to say, is there an actual demand that you could see in the marketplace, and try to align yourself in that market in terms of like your mental state, and really dive in head first into whatever category that is and do a ton of research. see if people would actually would want to do this, or if it makes sense in the sector that they're in. And then most importantly, these companies, especially in 2017, they had nothing to offer. They're just a web page and a white paper. And a web page and a white paper, I mean, they just don't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. It literally means nothing, in my opinion. A business plan, having, what kind of traction do you have so far already? Is this just an idea? Understanding, if this is a pre-seed or a seed or what it really is in the stage of the company is really important, so you understand the risk you're taking, right? So at the end of the day, a lot of these people, they are like, oh yeah, FOMO, and I'm going to make a lot of money with this token. Well, these utility tokens don't have any value.
There's no value. Their profitability is based on mass adoption, which, like, in a space where that is already experimental in nature, they're like adding another experiment to the pile that's like a spin-off of the original experiment, right? So it's like the path to profitability just isn't there.
It just isn't there. It's like a bunch of layers of for lack of better word, it's just a bunch of layers of bullshit is really what it is in a lot of these utility tokens. So, the best ones, It's funny because I was talking to my friend about this the other day. The best ones have good companies, and then their utility tokens are doing well because they're a good company, right? So take Binance, for example. Their utility token was really simple. You had a discount on your trades when it started, right? And then they also, I think they used them to pay employees and stuff like that, which is a really cool idea. They're outside the United States too, so they're able to move a lot faster. One thing that was, really interesting about Binance is that they built a good product. They built a good company, and that token did well because of that. Not because the token's ecosystem of what it did in utility was amazing. It wasn't. It was good because the business was good, and because the business was doing well, it made sense to have the token because it provided a good value for utility. That's the reason why Binance's token did really well. So I like to use that example and bring it to people and saying, hey, yeah, there is utility tokens that could be successful, but this is the reason why. It's because the company is a good company, and or not necessarily a good company, but is doing well or has traction, right? So that's really critical to take.
Right. And like operationally, they're succeeding. And I think that's one of the major factors that is lacking from a lot of those projects.
Yes. Yeah, I mean,
execution.
That you literally just hit on the nail on the head right there. I was just going to say that, Cass. So when it comes down to it, it's all about executing. You can idea yourself, you can group think, you can do whatever you want, brainstorm like crazy. But if you don't actually have something that you're executing on, it means absolutely nothing. It's just a bunch of words.
I think a lot of those projects would have done well existing in universities as like PhD projects personally. Not that, going and getting a PhD in philosophy isn't valuable, but like that they are experiments and they're highly theoretical and that it's not ready to, be on the market just yet. Because like you said, there's no demand. And I think oftentimes in this space that like there are a lot of really brilliant people here, but we often get ahead of ourselves and forget some of the, business 101 skills.
Yep. No, absolutely. I think that a little bit of healthy traditional business sense is definitely creeping into the market slowly. I see that kind of trending in the right direction, which is good because there's a lot of guys who are really smart, but everyone was moving way too fast. It's like, you guys are getting so far ahead of yourselves. It's kind of on the borderline of ridiculous in a lot of facets, in my opinion. But at the end of the day, it just comes down to having some traditional business sense is really important. If you don't know what that is, just go talk to somebody. They'll tell you, and you'll be like, holy crap, maybe I'm not ready to do this at full blown yet. Maybe I'm not. If you're, a new entrepreneur, or you're someone getting into space that's really has an exciting idea, go consult people that you trust, or at least you can, trust with an idea at least, or whatever that is, and then talk to them. Go vet information to understand how to run a business, because running a business involves a lot of paperwork and there's a lot of things that you have to do before you really become an actual thriving business. I mean, it's just crazy. Look at Amazon. I mean, it took them 10 years to actually start getting some real traction, for how much money was dumped to them early on.
So, and that idea evolved so many times too. Like Jeff Bezos, it was originally pretty much more or less just like purely a bookstore. I have a friend who her father was in Silicon Valley and he knew Jeff and they had some conversations about his like online book business. And he was like, all right, man, that's interesting. Good luck with that. But like didn't mention anything further about the business. And then
I love that.
Clearly it has evolved significantly since then. So
Yeah. So I have a saying that I like to take with me use a lot is the ability to pivot is the most important quality of all. I took this with me for many years. So I can't even begin to tell you, Cass, how many times Amazon's probably pivoted, hundreds of times, probably thousands, honestly. being able to be...
Yeah, the Amazon card.
Exactly. Being able to pivot is probably one of the most important factors of a company, because things are going to fail, ideas will not work, or they won't work as well. And you need to be able to be agile on your feet and think, okay, how do I overcome this quickly? And how do I move on to the next thing that might be a better idea? Or how do I revise this to make sure that we have the best version of what we're trying to accomplish here? That to me is critical in the business.
Absolutely. So before we sort of wrap things up here, I wanted to ask, what is the thing that you are most looking forward to that's on the horizon for Elite Mining?
Oh man, so much. We're really looking forward to our STO launching officially for subscriptions. Like I said, we're full ready to go. We got our lead investor, our lead VC, and a handful of accredited investors on board already. And we're really looking forward to our launch. We put a lot of hard work into this, especially being so unique. I believe we're the first equity security token for a mining business that's going to be on security token exchanges or
ATS.
I
was thinking so. This is the first time I've seen a model of this kind.
Yes, I believe we're the very first one. So we're very excited to prove that this is actually going to work. And like I said, in the background, we've done a tremendous amount of work to get this already here where it is, but also manage our risk and hedge against, hedge our bets, So it's also important, like in a company, like to make sure, like if you don't raise all this money, well, are you gonna be able to survive? And to us, the answer is yes. We've made sure of that. How we're gonna grow without, if we didn't hard cap or whatever. But we're planning on hard capping. Needless to say, we're not really betting on that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're gonna hard cap. That being said, though, that's really exciting for us moving forward. Our third location is obviously very, very exciting for us, because that's gonna be our phase two down the line, a year or so from now, which gets us to that fraction of a cent cost, which, basically makes us, we're de-risking our company to a tremendous amount. So an investment in EMI really means that you are investing in probably one of the better, we like to think the best, but I'm going to be, humble about it, one of the better green mining companies in the world. So, and that takes a lot to do. And we're really excited about that, Cass.
Yeah, no, you guys are definitely making waves in the space and are certainly positioned as one of the leaders in the mining space, in the Bitcoin mining space. So really, really glad that I was able to have you on today. Thanks so much for joining me. I know that we're, in the holidays and things are starting to get crazy. So I appreciate you taking the time to join me today. I wanted to let our audience know where they can find you and Elite Mining on social media.
Yeah, great. The best place to start would be going to elitemininginc.com. That's elitemininginc.com. And yes, Elite Mining was taken and we couldn't find who to buy it from. So it really sucked. So for that, you can go to elitemininginc.com. Look us up there. You also can go on Twitter at elitemininginc. You can go to, we're on Instagram as well. Same thing. And yeah, we are also on Telegram as well. Elite Mining Inc. For NTG. We're in multiple platforms.
What about your personal Twitter? If people want to stay up to date with the Seahawks and whatnot?
That's I think that's at Jay Padola, I believe. I actually don't remember off the top of my head.
Oh no! Don't worry. I'm going to toss all of this in our show notes here in the episode description. So, but yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @BitcoinCast, and you can follow the show at What's Happening. And of course, be sure to subscribe to What's Happening to stay up to date on the latest mining podcasts. Once again, thank you so much, Justin, for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You got a great thing going here, and you have an excellent one.
I appreciate it. Thank you. You too.
No. Bye bye.
All right, Justin. So I interviewed you a couple of weeks back, and it really worked out that I decided to hold off on publishing this interview because in the meantime, you've had a lot of really exciting announcements coming out. Isn't that right? I think the first of which we should probably cover would be your token offering. That's going to be the first week of March. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So we're going to be launching the offerings on March 3rd. We're really excited about it. There is a simultaneous offering of three different types.
So the first type being, are there options for like accredited investors, unaccredited investors? What are these three offerings look like?
So what we got is we have a Reg CF. Reg CF is 1,070,000 cap. It allows for unaccredited investors to come into the offering, which is we're really excited about that part. We're big believers in that. The government shouldn't be able to tell you what to do with your money. We think that people should invest where they want to invest with their own money. So that part's really cool. And I noticed the SEC has made some pretty good progress on the quote unquote accredited investor status, but they still, in my opinion, have quite a ways to go. The other offering is a Reg D506C. That is pretty typical and common. Most people know that, but just for those who don't, if you are inside the US, you make $200,000 a year, or you have 1 million net worth that you can prove on paper, then you're allowed to invest in the Reg D506C. The Reg S is the other one, which is a lot more convenient. If you're outside the US, you have the ability to do any type of, you know, it, you don't have to be accredited or uncredited, doesn't matter. The minimums are $7,500 for the Reg S, $7,500 for the Reg D, 506C, and $5,000 for the Reg CF for unaccredited investors.
What exactly, if someone decides to invest and what would be the number of tokens that they would receive and what exactly would they be able to do with these tokens? They essentially become shareholders more or less in Elite. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the average person that comes in to do a purchase or what we call subscriptions to the token, these are actually shares of the company, common B shares. These are non-voting type. So the reason why that's significant is because, you know, with tokens and voting, it becomes messy for equity. So we decided to take the voting part out of it, just leave that to our private common A shares. But you essentially have, for the common B shares, represented by the token itself. So these are EMI tokens, and these will have the promise of future liquidity on markets, such as Open Finance Network, T0, other exchanges outside of the US, as in London, et cetera, other security token exchanges that can come on board. Inside the US, they're called ATS, Alternative Trading Systems. So those are the promise of future liquidity in a very nascent market. The beauty is that you don't have to wait, you know, 5 to 6, 10 years, depending on what type of investor you are. VCs typically are, you know, they bet on waiting that long. Security tokens give the promise or the hopeful promise of liquidity within, you know, 1 to 3 years, depending on the company and its, you know, and the way it functions.
So do you have any plans with what you're going to do with the money that you raise from these token offerings?
Yes, absolutely.
Are you allocating it?
Yes, for sure. The allocation right now is we're going to spend quite a bit of money on our acquisitions of renewable energy. So we got solar slated, we have hydro slated, we have obviously a large portion is going to be dedicated towards purchasing of miners, et cetera. The other parts of the money we're going to be spent on legal fees, marketing, advertising, et cetera.
Cool. And you guys are pretty transparent about this. I think there's a slide or something like that on your website. Isn't that right?
100%.
On how all that's allocated.
Yeah. There's a complete allocation table there. On the website itself, you can go on www.elitemininginc.com. You can see the pitch deck is going to be on there during the offering. There's a full detail of everything there. And like you just said, Cass, we're definitely transparent and open. We like people that come in and challenge us, ask us questions. We are definitely a democratized type of company. We have a large board. We love people that can bring value and challenge us in any questions. So we love conversation and discussion.
Thanks to all my listeners out there for tuning in to today's episode of What's Happening. The What's Happening podcast is a BTC Media produced podcast on the Let's Talk Bitcoin network. It was produced and edited by Christian Carolas. You can find more podcasts covering Bitcoin on the Let's Talk Bitcoin network and can follow them on Twitter at the LTB network for all the latest episodes.